gentlemen, I'm Sankalp representing PMSEIF World. Welcome to yet another episode of MK Alpha Mavens. And today's topic is very interesting. It's called How Alternative Investments Are Changing the Way HNIs and Ultra HNIs Are Creating Wealth. So this has been talk of the town for a while. A lot of innovation has happened here. A lot of new products have come. And we thought we'd get an expert here and discuss all things that are alternates now for HNI investors and ultra HNI investors. So let me introduce, as we customarily do at the beginning of the session, let me introduce all our esteemed guests. We'll start with Mr. Nitin Singh. Nitin, can you please wave to our audience today? Thank you. Although Nitin needs very little introduction, let me just give a little bit detail about his career so far and all the interesting things that he has done. He's an MBA from IIM Bangalore and a graduate in economics from DU. So he started his career with HSBC across multiple roles, and he spent a good 17 years there at HSBC across geographies and across various roles. He managed responsibility of close to $40 billion at HSBC. He established the global fund desks at HSBC and strategic partnerships with asset managers and led the distribution for the mutual funds and ETF across the private banking and other verticals at HSBC. From there, Nitin moved on to Standard Chartered Bank, where he was the managing director and head of wealth management business. He headed a 300-member team that managed close to $14 billion in 2019. He was also on the board of Standard Chartered Securities and a member of the country management team for Standard Chartered Bank. And his latest stint, as you all know, is as the MD and CEO of Avendus Wealth Management. You know, he's got close to now what, around 2.5 decades of experience heading, you know, private banking establishments and other areas of investment management. So that's a deep and very, very well diverse experience that Nitin brings to us, brings for us today. And it'd be a very, very interesting session listening to him and his views. And we have two veterans with us today asking the questions, Vikas and Sachin. So let me just start with Vikas. Vikas M. Sachdeva is the CEO of MK Investment Managers right now. And before that, he has headed multiple asset management organizations like Edelweiss. And before that, he was involved with a lot of AMFI committees and a few SEBI committees. So he has a lot of experience on the asset management side, and he is almost been there as long as the industry. Sorry, Vikas, I don't want to insinuate that you are growing old, but you've been long enough.
I'm just worried. You said he's a CEO right now. So I was just wondering what you mean by that. Do you know something I don't?
No. Jokes apart. And Vikas, thank you for being with us on all the episodes so far and asking some really great questions to the guests. Second last of the introductions is, of course, Mr. Sachin Shah, who's the fund manager at MK Investment Managers. He is very well known for creating his framework of EQUAL, which is a proprietary framework at MK Investment Managers for choosing great and good businesses with very, very proficient managements. And he has been in the industry, fund management industry, for close to 2 decades now. He's worked at Motilal Oswal and now at almost been 12 years at MK. So welcome, Vikas, Sachin and Nitin. The last introduction is to the guests on the show today. We have a very special prize for the best question on this episode, sponsored by FinLearn Academy, which is a one-stop shop for everything that you need to know and learn about the stock markets, right from trading to investments. So, having said the context and given the introductions, I now hand over the floor to you, Vikas, to do your style of introduction of the guest. And let the ball roll.
Thank you so much, Sankalpo. I think before I start off, I must also thank PMSEIF World. Sankalpo, especially you, you've been the host along with us. Time flies. We started this series in Jan this year. This is the 12th episode and probably the last episode of season one. And as like Nitin pointed out, we saved the best for the last. So it's been an eventful journey. I would like to start off by thanking our audiences. I see a lot of familiar names coming in. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for your feedback. Your feedback has actually helped us grow, evolve, and come up with even better propositions in terms of questions. Some of your questions, by the way, have been amazing. So, and I can see a lot of these questions which have come in today as well. please keep sending your questions during this discussion so that we can make this a more interactive and a more fruitful discussion for all of you. As is customary, I'm going to introduce Nitin the way his colleagues, his friends, a lot of people see him, and some insights about him, which will bring out the person behind the professional. I think his professional resume is quite impressive. And as I go along, you'll find out that he's one person who doesn't take himself too seriously. Success rests very lightly on his shoulders. I, for one, wouldn't have realized the depth of his CV till the time I heard Sankalp talk about it. He's so nice and forthcoming when he comes across. In fact, that's something which is a common word all your colleagues describe you as, Nitin. They describe you as being friendly. That's a word I heard almost everywhere. You give people space and you allow them to be themselves. People have talked about your style of management as non-obtrusive, and people really respect this. In fact, they've told me that they like you so much as a person that they're willing to walk that extra mile for you when it really, really comes. You're a foodie and you actually relish all types of cuisines. One of your colleagues actually told me that if a dabba is going around in the office, you can rest assured that Nitin will definitely take a sample of that. In fact, I believe you have the culinary map of Mumbai embedded in your mind. You know which restaurant does serve what food in what place, and people normally consult you for that. I've also been told when people go out with you for functions, for dinner, they leave the ordering of food to you. You're so good at that. It's not just food that you relish, it's also books. You're an omnivorous book reader. You have close to 100 books at home. That's amazing, 100 books at home. Off late, however, people have been noticing that, reading has probably taken a backseat to the number of balance sheets and reports that you've been going through. Yeah. Fitness-wise, you have your moments, as they put it. When you are into it, you prefer yoga and gymming. However, since you're a foodie, you're such a foodie, you will probably lose 10 kg and then put 15 kg back on. You have a lovely wife, a lovely family. Son Johan is 9. Wife Priyanka has recently taken a break from a very successful career as a CXO level search executive. You also have a French bulldog called Leon, over whom the entire family dotes over. You're the life of the party, and I can imagine the last 24 hours that I've been interacting with you through the dry run and this, you must be the life of the party. People vouch for that. And usually you are the center of attraction at any event you attend. So if you find Nitin at every event, you can just go wherever there's a crowd, probably Nitin's at the center of it, is what I've been told. Last but not the least, and this is the one which I really love the most, your hobby is quitting cigarettes. You do that quite often. Thank you so much, Nitin, for taking time and speaking to us. It's a privilege for us to host you and get your insights.
Thank you, Vikas. And I would just like to say that please treat everything that he says with a grain of salt, because it almost sounds like the only thing I do is party and eat food and not work. So I hope I'm able to dispel some of those notions during the course of this interaction. But thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure, given the luminaries who've come on the show, and I hope I'm able to meet everyone's expectations in terms of shedding some light on something that is truly exciting and something that was new to me as well 2 years ago when I made the transition from Standard Chartered to Avendis. And looking forward to this conversation with both of you. Heard some great things about both you as well as Sachin. And really looking forward to this conversation.
So thank you. On that, you taking a more serious note, let us start the questions. So, I'd like you to, for the sake of the audience, start by defining.
I just ran a poll before we go to the questions. Let's discuss the audience here and it'll give perspective to Nitin. So I just asked, I have invested in these alternates. The options were PMS, PMS, and the second option was AIF long short. The third was AIF private equity, private debt, crypto or REITs or InvITs. 75% of the audience has invested in PMS and AIF long short is another 12%, and AIF private equity or debt is another 10%. REITs, crypto is none, and REITs and InvITs are around 8%.
Maybe you'll have a lot more people talking about crypto once the budget session happens. So right now it'll be none. I'm not surprised. But it's very interesting. Nitin, when I started my career off in asset management around 25 years ago, at that point of time, mutual funds used to be alternates, you know, and mutual funds have become mainstream right now. So how do you define alternates in today's context? How are they different from mainstream investments?
Oh, I completely agree with you, Vikas. And I remember when you and I were talking, we were talking exactly the same thing, saying that when we started our careers, people used to say, like, why should I put money into a mutual fund? How will I burn my hands? Nobody had a sense of fixed income or equity. And the way that, and getting every SIP used to be one, you know, a moment of celebration compared to Touchwood, where the industry is today.
Yes.
I think, and I think the definition of alternates changes over a period of time. So, for example, when Sankalp was talking about 75% of it being in PMS, I actually don't think of PMS as alternates any longer. Because I believe that the age of looking for high quality managers in equity, given the perfect information that exists today in public markets, given the fact that a lot of mutual funds, you know, especially the large cap funds, find it very difficult to beat benchmark returns. And given the amount of information available today, I think PMS managers are playing more and more of a mainstream role today. So actually, when you ask me, I'm not even thinking of the 75%. So it actually struck me saying that, okay, if we are defining alternates as PMS, then it takes a very different direction.
Interesting.
But, you know, if I define it simply, alternates in today's context, in my mind, basically falls into two categories, right? The basic asset classes remain the same. Equity and fixed income. As you rightly said, we're not getting into conversations around crypto, NFT, art, etc. You know, bored apes. I mean, that's a conversation over a drink rather than a you know, serious conversation right now. And that space will evolve. But if you look at sophisticated investors in the land today, and typically most financial investors, that actually tends to fall into two categories, right? From an equity perspective, typically alternates today are defined as non-listed equity. And typically from a fixed income perspective, it actually falls into two categories, right? One is the kind of long short and you know, absolute return strategies that Sankalp was referring to. But I think even more and more, it actually refers to non-tradable debt, right? And therefore, when you're looking at both equity and fixed income as asset classes, to a large extent, you can separate them between public and private, and public and private, you know, both in terms of equity and debt. Typically, the nature of these investments is, and just a rule of thumb, they're typically more illiquid. They're typically less understood, right? They typically have the propensity of being able to offer higher return, right? They typically tend to attract higher tax, actually. As I said, information is not as widely available. And, you know, and I think the last piece, which is very unique, is that you will typically tend to see both managers, outfits, as well as firms being typically people who are new generation and entrepreneurial rather than institutional. So I think that's how I would actually define alternates in today's context, right? You know, be it in terms of non-listed equity, be it in terms of non-tradable debt, right? And then, of course, you have many asset classes below it, be it in terms of, you know, long short, be it in terms of looking at, you know, venture debt, venture equity, early stage, mid stage, late stage. So that's really the definition that I would put in terms of alternates today.
That's very interesting. And thank you for such a nuanced perspective on alternates, which probably brings me to my next question. The way alternates are looked at, I think the regulator has a filter in terms of a minimum ticket size. That is what I think is one criteria to defend savviness of the investor coming in. Obviously, you know, there is a lot more which an investor needs to take in. You talked about illiquidity, you talked about returns, and it's probably a savvy investor which can come in. But savviness here is defined by the regulator primarily in terms of the minimum ticket size. You know, according to you, which type or what type of investors should seek out alternates as part of their portfolio? What should be the investor profile?
And I think it's a very good question. And I think the answer is just not one. So the answer is not only in terms of size of portfolio, but I think it's also in terms of the sophistication of the customer and the kind of understanding that he has. So typically forget the size of the portfolio, but if you're a person who has a conservative risk profile, right, where you are basically uncomfortable with, let's say, loss of capital in any form or manner, you know, both either in the short term or the long term, and you are typically a person who, you know, typically when you, so if you take a step back and you look at risk profiles, you're still talking about conservative, moderate, aggressive, and you can come up with many of them in between. The kind of behavior that I have noticed over the last few years is basically two. One is typically that more and more UHNIs, and you know, typically I'm talking about people who today have a financial wealth in excess of, let's say, 25 to 50 crores and upwards, right? As well as people, and therefore people who can afford the liquidity within the portfolio, right? Secondly, people who have a mindset of trying to ensure that they're able to sustainably beat inflation within their portfolio on an overall asset allocation perspective and truly create alpha, right? Thirdly, are people who are basically able to take, can hold assets over the longer term and can take the vagaries of the typical cycle that goes with these assets. And fourthly, people who are really willing to pay a fee for the value add that this provides is really the investors that I believe are suitable for this. Now, typically, if you actually look at it, it's very interesting because when these trends become more and more popular with UHNIs, you tend to suddenly see a democratizing of this access opportunity that happens. And therefore, I mean, crypto is a perfect example, right? I mean, it's actually started from the bottom up, right? So therefore, you've got millions and billions of investors investing. People are talking about $6 billion of flows, etc., that are happening. I don't know how that story will end, and I don't think we should use today's forum to talk about that. But you're similarly seeing the story happen in private market assets as well, right? You've got two ends of the spectrum. You've got one is sophisticated investors who over the last few years have taken I think for sophisticated UHNI investors, alternate assets are becoming more and more mainstream. And I'll actually answer that question for two reasons, because they're realizing, if all of you remember, there's this very famous guy called David Simpson, and Sachin would surely know, given that he's an investment professional, right? Who ran the endowment for Yale, right? And he unfortunately passed away about a year ago, but he was one of the most successful institutional fund managers globally. And he propounded this thesis about perfect markets and imperfect markets, right? And he basically said that as markets become more and more perfect, which is basically stuff like, from an Indian perspective, let's talk about public equities, let's talk about AAA debt, let's talk about a lot of assets where there's a lot of significant amount of public information available. Today the democratization of that information and the fact that it is available at on this basically means that the propensity of a fund manager or of anyone to make significant alpha, right, over market returns becomes smaller and smaller. Therefore, typically what tends to happen is that for any sophisticated investor, you're basically looking at two pockets of assets. And because I'm sorry, I'm actually digressing.
No, this is very interesting. Please go ahead. Yeah.
But typically you look at two pockets of assets. You look at public market assets, be it either equity or fixed income. There, the biggest piece is that how do you ensure that you meet market returns and how do you find the cheapest cost of getting into those assets, right? And therefore, which is why the preponderance of ETFs, hedge funds, REITs, InvITs, Bharat Bond, all of that has taken off to a different level and scale. The second piece that you say is that these are typically assets that will maybe just about meet inflation, etc. But if you want to have alpha in your portfolio, you need to have a portion of imperfect assets, right? Where really the selection of the fund manager, the selection of the security can create substantial alpha in your portfolio over a period of time.
Correct.
So there are two questions that basically matter in that. First is, what is the asset allocation that you should have, right? And the second one is, what is the choice of the instrument that you get into? And I've seen over the last two and a half years, and especially since COVID, that there's been an acceleration of this trend where these assets are becoming more and more mainstream for large customers, right? People are realizing that the only way to create an overall alpha within their portfolio, right? And I like to call it to future-proof their portfolio, right, is to have exposure to these assets. And it falls both across equity, fixed income. It'll fall both across access through early stage, mid stage and late stage funds, as well as access to direct deals, right? But people are actually now thinking of these asset classes in almost exactly the same way that they were thinking about public markets earlier. You should have mid cap, you should have small cap, you should have large cap, you should have sectoral biases, you should have thematic plays, right? You should look at fixed income, across the whole spectrum. People are similarly thinking of this space in the same manner. You should have venture debt, you should have structured credit, you should look at great, well quality, good quality companies, be it either new age or well-run private market companies that you would want to invest in, either from a debt or equity perspective. And it's all, and it's a new burgeoning asset class emerging that I believe will become more and more mainstream in the years to come. So, sorry, you asked me a question only about investors, but I ended up speaking much more. So, my apologies.
It's actually very nuanced. And honestly, I think the penny dropped when you started talking about the fact that the way people talk about it in public markets, mid cap, large cap, small cap, and all of that, and the way they're talking in private markets, I think I could just immediately make that connection, that correlation. So I think thank you so much for elaborating that. And I'm sure Sachin has a few questions now. Sorry, Sankalpo, you have something? Yeah.
We can't hear you, Sankalpo.
Sankalpo can't hear you.
Sorry, the mic was off. Yeah, so the poll that I did while Vikas was delving into the question was, why would I consider an alternate product? You know, so just while we're discussing who is the investor. So the options were, why would one consider an alternate product? The options were returns, risk mitigation, participation in new businesses, novelty of the product, or more than one of the above. So 50% said that they would look at an alternate for returns only. 21% said participation in new businesses assets, and 15% said more than one of the above. So that's where our audience is looking at alternates at.
Yeah, thanks, Sankalpo. Actually, that was exactly my question. You know, Nitin, what I wanted to understand was that, you know, generally the way investors perceive, why am I investing into alternates? And that's one of the big reasons even the polls mentioned that is to increase my returns. It's for getting better returns or getting higher returns. But in your experience, is that the only value addition that the alternates do to the entire portfolio or to the wealth?
Sachin, a very good question. I think also very topical poll, and I was just laughing when I was taking those numbers down. But so I think firstly, as I said, you know, and as I propounded earlier, I think this word alternates will soon be history, because you will start differentiating between, like the word mutual funds earlier used to be, right? It used to apply to everything across the board, equities, fixed income, etc. Right? My parents never understood it. Today, my same father understands the difference between a S&P and a short-term debt fund and you know, and a mid-cap equity fund. And there was a point of time when all of that was the same, right? But I think, and to answer the question that that Sankalpo said, I think the reason for that, I would say, is 100% more than one of the above, right? Which is that the value add of using is essentially the following, right? First is, as I spoke about, the fact that, yes, there is a higher propensity to return, right? Be it either through absolute return strategies, be it through participation in new and emerging businesses and sectors, you know, for example, digital, deep tech, etc. You can only do through unlisted space, or you know, alternate assets do through new disruptive industries that are continuously emerging. Interestingly, and I think all of you will agree with me, and including all of the members or listening as well, I think it's a great time to be an entrepreneur, because as we were growing up, and I think when Sankalpo spoke about the fact that I'd spent 2.5 decades, I felt very old. But I realized that one of the pieces that has changed dramatically in the last 3 years, I would say, and especially more since COVID versus earlier, was that there is an abundance of capital available for the right idea, right? When we were all growing up, the biggest issue used to be capital for the right ideas, right? And therefore, we grew up in a world where capital was the most important piece. Today, capital is available for the best ideas. Also, one of the pieces, therefore, that happened at that point of time was that the only way that you traditionally grew within your businesses was that finally your ultimate goal was go public, raise money, deploy it within the business. Today, actually, the concept of a high-quality business is no longer public and private, right? There are significant high-quality businesses that continue to remain private for longer, right? Because you know, and I talk to entrepreneurs every day, and they basically say that, you know, we don't necessarily see the need to do that, right? And I think therefore what is happening is that one is access to high quality businesses, right? And using the word alternates, right? Whether it's private or public, you find a way of accessing them. Access to new age businesses, and therefore future proofing your portfolio, right? Third, which is a very interesting point, is about lower correlation to traditional asset classes. You know, when somebody asks me, and customers typically ask me this question saying, you know, what can go wrong? What can happen? How do I create returns within my portfolio? And I typically tend to tell people that the biggest enemy to creating long-term returns in a portfolio, if you want to know that, you please go and stare yourself in the mirror, right? Because we Indians and typically investors have a bias for action, right? And therefore, both as wealth managers as well as investors, when things will happen in the market, right, you typically want to have that bias to action, right? So you will go and book profits, you do a lot of things. And of course, all of that is right from an asset allocation perspective. But at times, holding assets for longer term, right, having that propensity to ensure, and you know, and a lot of these assets therefore are such way you have, where you're perforce made to hold things for longer term, right? Whether you're in a venture cap fund, whether you're in a private equity fund, whether you bought an unlisted asset, right, whilst there is a secondary market available today and it is growing. But typically when you invest in these assets, even in your own mind, you're thinking of it as the longer term. You're not subject again to the vagaries of what you look here every day to say, okay, has this moved 10%, 20%, shall I sell? And therefore the value add for customer portfolios, as I said, is one is just putting it in an elevator pitch, return increases while risk reduces, both because of diversification, because of lower correlation to traditional asset classes, and because of the fact that you're able to take away the bias to action, which at times can be something that is detrimental to the longer term health of your portfolios.
Sure, I think that was very helpful. There is one more thing that I wanted to understand was that, today there are many investors who are still uninitiated, or they'll probably be first time exposed to these alternates. So are there a few things that they should be mindful about before they actually, get into it?
Yeah, I think a very good question. And I think let me answer this in terms of two things. See, typically the way people have been exposed to the way that we are defining alternates is that either a lot of us have gone and done a lot of angel investments, 1 lakh here, 50,000 here, 2 lakhs here, 10 lakhs here, etc., which was that phase a few years ago, right? A lot of us, any person who had money, whatever, used to spend time on weekends meeting entrepreneurs and trying to, and therefore, interestingly, and this reminds me of a time 15, 20 years ago, where the first exposure of people to even the equity markets was by buying mid and small cap shares, because somebody gave them a tip and they bought it, and then they burned their hands and then didn't get back in for 5 or 10 years. I remember my dad doing such a thing when I was in, I don't remember which grade, 8th or 9th grade, where he went and, he was an army officer, he went and put in some money into an interesting company, which is still listed, and therefore I will not talk about it. But I don't think the share price has moved from in the last 20 years in any form or manner. And then after that, it took me about 20 years to get him back into the market through SIPs, right? And I think to some extent that happened a few years ago. And I think if my only one submission is that, see, as I was talking about it earlier, the information arbitrage available at the higher end with sophisticated investors is to a different level. That has basically created an ecosystem today, right, where advisors and wealth managers are becoming much more knowledgeable about this segment than they were previously, right? Therefore, typically, I think the other piece that has happened is that we've given the regulatory, and I think SEBI's done some great work in terms of, trying to tame mis-selling, trying to tame, the whole buyer beware concept, and, trying to put more onus on sellers and advisors and distributors to really do the right thing. And therefore, my point over here is essentially the following. See, what you have to remember is there's a lot of information arbitrage in this space, as most of the information is not available in the public domain. The second is that the difference between a performing and a non-performing manager can be very significant, right? The third is, of course, the difference between a performing and a non-performing asset, in terms of buying something directly is, just all over the place. Hence, doing rigorous evaluation and selection of the right opportunity is very important, right? Which can only happen with an advisor or a distributor who has got deep expertise in this space and who has access to all relevant product and data. So to give you an example, I like to quote that in a vendor's our understanding of the space begins where the understanding of everybody else ends. Because we got into the space about 4 or 5 years ago, and we developed a go-to-market today where we work with every leading private equity, venture capital, early stage, mid-stage player within the land. right? We have access and information to every top quality company, both, you know, from a late stage or a mid stage that is available within the market. We've got access and information across the venture debt, structured credit category, which is second to none, right? And we typically look at opportunities. So typically we don't even do product selection. We actually do product rejection. So therefore, if we are looking at 10 IDRs, we'll typically be rejecting 8 of them. And we've also learned along the way, right? If you ask me today, one of the pieces that customers ask me is saying that should I be investing in an early stage firm? And I normally like to say that the rule of thumb of the olden days was that you had lots of angel investments directly, right? And then you had invested in some funds. Today, my piece is that from a equity perspective, early stage and mid stage opportunities should only be looked to funds, because the burn rate in these investments can be so high that you need to have a portfolio approach to be able to make money. When you look at late stage investments, which are, let's say, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years away from IPO, companies that have become sizable, companies that have developed market leadership positions, companies that have got strong moats around what they're doing, be it either in the digital or the non-digital space, right? You can there take both approaches. You can get into some direct assets, or you can get in through funds as well, right? But the problem that still remains is the fact that minimum ticket sizes of getting into these instruments still tends to remain high, right? So therefore, you've seen an emergence of gray market players where you will typically be exchanging OYO, Ola, Paytm shares before it got listed, or, you know, so you've got a very thriving gray market growing. But I think over a period of time, it will define itself. But my only rule of thumb for anyone looking at alternate investments today is do it through proper rigorous advice, right? Work with advisors and distributors who can look at the space. Diversify your portfolio. Right? Start small, right? So even if you've got a large sum of money, you should typically dip your toes in and grow it over a period of time. Yeah. Sorry, Vikas, you were saying.
I think that was interesting.
Great. A lot of insights. Thank you, Vikas.
You said period of time. I agree. In fact, again, one of the things I just picked up from what you said, product rejection more than product selection. I think that sort of rigor really makes sense. A portfolio approach. I think these are very, very useful sort of perspectives which are coming in.
So in fact, to tell you this, so I would say when we are looking at selection or rejection of a fund, we're looking at a variety of factors. We're looking at, of course, the normal stuff, which is past track record, benchmarking with peers, team. But we'll get into huge amount of ref checks, companies, you know, if a manager has worked with 20 companies, what do the 20 founders have to say through their existence?
Yes.
What is the governance mechanisms? You know, what are the mistakes that people can make? What are errors of commission and errors of omission? In the last 1 year and going into the next few months, I think we'll end up selling roughly about $1 billion of such risk assets, you know, be it across venture capital, private equity, venture debt, and, you know, structured debt. And therefore, the onus on us today as an advisor or a distributor is very high. And I think that's typically the same with most players now, most well-established players across the land, because this is an asset class that nobody can ignore. People are investing in it in a big way. And as an investor, you should be making use of, you know, the expertise that all of these people are bringing. Of course, markets can lead to irrational outcomes at times. But if you're able to get into a good quality name, either equity or debt, and hold it over the longer period, you will make your money.
No, I completely agree. In fact, one of the reasons why I could empathize with what you were saying, product rejection more than product selection, is I think that is pretty much what Sachin does in terms of listed equity when he's running this equal model. We've often been questioned by people, you know, this looks like a great stock. It made a lot of money. Why have you not picked it up? And I think that is where the courage of conviction and the process is, and of course, the expertise starts coming in. I particularly like the fact, you know, you made a statement saying that where people's expertise ends, that is where we live. Brilliant. I think that was very, very, very nuanced. Thank you so much for sharing that. A question which I have for you is, you know, we are seeing the growth of the Indian alternate industry, and it's starting to gain momentum in a particular direction, if you will. You've had such a vast global exposure to a variety of asset classes and a variety of industries. And today, alternates are a thriving multi-billion dollar industry globally. I'm just stopping short of using the word trillion, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry out there. Do you think that the Indian alternates industry is moving around a particular trajectory which is akin to what the global alternates industry is, or is it something completely different which we are evolving on our own?
No, I think as I mentioned earlier, this alternates the word, I mean, be it either in debt or in equity, is going to become more and more mainstream in the years to come. I think it is, in the West, especially the US, alternates are highly evolved, right? I mean, you look at SPICs, you look at SPACs, you look at various other pieces, you look at platforms that actually, create all kind of interesting variety of products. You look at how people perceive this, right? I mean, they're extremely involved. India is still in its phase one, right?
Okay.
However, there's been a lot of, and I'll tell you one of the reasons for that. And one of the reasons for that was the fact that quality managers in the past, be it either in equity or debt, always raised offshore capital, right? So if you look at most of the great quality managers that have emerged out of India, I think it's a, if you ask me, and this is very philosophical, but I think it's a shame that so many companies, and a lot of the wealth that has been created in India from a digital and, everything that's going to be created, the primary beneficiaries of that continue to be foreign funds, right? Because they realize, which is a similar story, in public companies.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
FII has first followed now, and today it's DIIs and retail that rule the roost.
Absolutely.
Right?
Deja vu.
And,
yeah.
And it's a similar story that happened on equity and fixed income as well, right? On alternate equity and fixed income as well. But I think in the last few years, I think there's been a ready realization of two things. One is the fact that people are realizing that they need to raise domestic capital, right? Because the Indian financial wealth is growing at a rapid pace, right? The second is that customers are becoming more and more sophisticated, and both managers as well as customers are realizing that this is an ecosystem that they need to be within from a symbiotic nature, right? And therefore, if you ask me, I'm terribly excited about how the space is going to build. I do believe that it's largely going to be dependent on, to a large extent also, on how the regulator and how the tax framework evolves. I think SEBI has been, to a large extent, forward-looking. I think the evolution of the accredited investor regulations that have come out will, to a large extent, define. You see, typically what used to happen earlier was that it was one size fits all. Mm. So you had to regulate the broker sitting in Indore who was, let's talk about the RIA regulation, right? You have to regulate the broker sitting in Indore or the person calling and, doing all kind of whatever, all the way to regulating somebody like me or whatever. And it was the same size across it, right? And which is where you end up stifling innovation in some form or another. But I have to give credit to SEBI. I think it's a very forward-looking regulator. I think, they have looked at this space clearly. I hope regulations don't become too tight for innovation to stop. But I do believe that if it continues to evolve in the next 10 to 15 years, there is no reason why we would not become similar to West, except maybe international assets. Because I do truly believe that the true time for international assets in India will really happen when LRS becomes much more liberalized. I think you've seen the way international assets are now growing in India to the extent that you've got mutual funds now writing back to SEBI and RBI to say, please free up the limit for us to allow more, money to flow into the funds because you're seeing so much money coming. And therefore, the interesting aspect of this, Sachin and Vikas, is that look at the underlying behavior of investors. The amount of learning that investors have had over the last 24 months. And therefore, the way that any sophisticated family office in the land today in India is now behaving more and more like anybody that you would see offshore.
Mm.
Right? Maybe with the fact that, of course, still 90% of the assets continue to remain in India. But the questions that they ask, the diligence that they do, the benefits that they see to give you a sense, we at Avendus work with about 1,500 odd families. Roughly about 50% of the families that we work with have at least $100 million plus of financial net worth, right? Therefore, we are, touch wood, working with the who's who in the land, right? What we are seeing over the last 2 years, and especially for somebody like us who was a little bit of a late entrant as compared to the IIFLs and Kotaks to become relevant with these families, is that families want only one thing from a wealth manager, that they're looking for value add, right? And value add comes in terms of three things. Value add comes in terms of the right advice and the right asset allocation. Value add comes in terms of product selection and innovation, right? And value add comes in terms of the fact that they believe that the manager that they are working with is able to think of trends and actually get people in at the right time, be it across equity, public fixed income, be it across private equity, private fixed income, right? And these are the three value adds that they are really looking at a wealth manager. So therefore, I mean, we have tremendously invested not only in this piece, but we try to make those three points of value add at the center of our existence to say that if you're able to provide that value add to these customers, right, they will do more and more business with us because they see that it's not a typical distributor any longer, but somebody that is truly involved in terms of wealth creation within our portfolios. So yeah, so to answer your question, I'm terribly excited about how this space is going to evolve. I think there's a lot of work yet. I think SEBI still has to make some changes. Like, to give you a perfect example, currently you're not allowed to multi-pool customers into a single asset, right? Which is almost like a spick and spack globally, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore democratization of customers being able to get into single assets, right, will take a little bit longer, right? I think it's a process of evolution. If given the right guidance, you know, tax still continues to be an issue for Cat 3, right? I mean, there are still a few niggling issues, but I think if people work towards the benefit of the industry, benefit towards trying to make this into a larger space, and you know, I think this too will evolve.
Very interesting. In fact, you've already answered my next question, which I was going to ask you in terms of, you know, what sort of alternate trends do you think will have a substantial interest going forward in this country? So probably I would skip that question.
So I think one thing that I can talk about more and more is, I think there are two things that I've had. So if I take a step back and, you know, I don't talk about alternate trends, but if I talk about what's going to shape India in the next 10 years, and I'd love Sachin to comment on it as well. If you ask me, there are three trends that are unstoppable, right? And I'm not talking about markets today and, you know, how they are valued, etc. But the three trends that are unstoppable. The first trend is that there is a digital revolution happening in India, right? And therefore, you're seeing companies emerge and you're seeing digital models emerge, which are completely disrupting traditional business models. The go-to-market, the target addressable market, how these businesses grow, how they are solving for specific problems, right? And how they're building moats around their businesses is just outstanding, right? And it's going to change the shape and nature of the way India functions, right? I think, you know, we can have hours of discussion around how this is, but I think all of us realize that this is now at the center of the existence of our lives, right? And I think just the rapid emergence of this, right, from rural to semi-urban to urban, and how you're seeing amazing B2C businesses emerge, B2B businesses emerge, SaaS-led businesses emerge, it's just outstanding. And this is what will create the next wave of wealth creation in India, both for traditional businesses and new businesses, because even traditional businesses are reimagining their business models built on the back of digital. So that is the first trend that I think is going to create wealth creation in India. The second trend that I believe, which I think the time has come to roost finally, is of large-scale manufacturing in India, right? Many times over the last few years, and I'm sure Sachin and Vikas and you, we've all done that whole shown a slide with the dragon and the tiger and said, you know, dragon will, this will happen and tiger will come up, etc., etc. But I do believe that the time of large-scale manufacturing and this China plus one strategy to a large extent is playing out. And if you get our act right over the course of the next year or so, the big are becoming bigger. You know, there is large-scale manufacturing trends that are emerging in India. The brownfield and greenfield projects being launched all over the country, and the nature of balance sheets of companies, of market leaders in India today is much more stronger than it has been in a very long time. And therefore, I believe that in this space as well, over the next 10 years, you'll see amazing, you know, wealth creation opportunities. And the third one is really the whole ESG piece, right? Mm. I mean, be it right from electric mobility to sustainable, well-run, governed businesses, right? I think these three trends will define India over the next 10 years. And therefore, to a very interesting point, access to these three trends, right, be it either through equity or debt, today lies within traditionally the alternate space, right?
Interesting.
And therefore, you know, be it alternate equity, be it alternate debt, be it venture debt, be it high yield credit, I think, you know, people should be very closely looking at this space and making it more and more mainstream within their portfolio.
In fact, Sachin, before you go on to your questions, yeah. I just realized that it's already been 47 minutes since we've been. So no wonder I think people love you, Nitin. I've just got caught up in the entire conversation. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
It's been very, very engaging. So what I'm going to do, Sachin, is a lot of audience questions are also coming in. After your couple of questions, I'm going to straight away switch to audience questions in the interest of time. Is that okay with you, Nitin?
I'm fine. And I apologize if I spent too much time talking to you, not being able to finish your questions. But
No, not at all. In fact, I wish I've been told that you have a hard stop at 6:30. Otherwise, I can go on and on for another half an hour. I'm finding this extremely engaging. Yeah,
Nitin, so, you know, all the three trends that you mentioned, and I think I can't agree more. We internally are actually really strategizing that how can we actually play all these three themes in our public market investing. And in fact, Vikas is a witness to that. The IC meetings that we have on a weekly basis, where we actually keep on, you know, discussing on this part. So, you know, I completely agree and can't agree more actually. Just, you know, one of the very important points that you also mentioned is in terms of the value addition to the investors from the wealth side is about the right advice and the right allocation, the first point that you mentioned. Just taking that piece for the alternates, I know it's a very general question that, you know, what is the typical a good allocation for alternates in any investor's portfolio? It's a very general thing. I'm sure it depends on every client profile, their risk appetite and all of that. But, you know, is there any thumb rule? Like, for example, you know, when we started our careers, there was always this one thumb rule, 100 minus your age for each.
No, very allocation. For equity right. Allocation, I remember.
Yeah, right. So, is there something like that you can share for alternate?
Again, as I said, and I'm again coming back to that nuance, alternate is a very misabused word. And as you realize during the course of this conversation, I don't think it means, I actually like to break this up in the following manner. So, I think that every family and every client is at a very different stage in their alternate allocation journey, right? And I have always been a very firm believer of the fact that, and you know, it is like the insurance piece, right? To a large extent, a lot of people say that alternates they are sold, not bought, right? Mm-hmm. Because for various reasons, et cetera, et cetera. So I firmly believe that one is the three trends that I talked about. And if I talk about the first trend, which is digital, right? I believe in the longer run, for a moderate to aggressive asset allocation portfolio, in the longer run, people should have at least a 15 to 20% exposure to the digital thing, right? Whether it's through public or private, time will decide, right? Tomorrow you could have outstanding companies that are in the public domain, but have that piece to it.
Sure.
Typically, what we say today is that we advise clients to start small. If you had no experience, no expertise, no exposure to this, it is important to start small. Right, because it's an ecosystem that's building up, and it's very important to slowly allocate across products, vintages, and asset classes over a period of time to take your alternate allocation to, let's say, 10 to 20% of your portfolio. Right, so the rule of thumb is anywhere between 5 to 25%, depending upon your comfort levels on the nature of the investment that I talked about, illiquid, less information arbitrage, you know, holding for long periods of time. Right. I mean, you have to think of it in that way and manner.
Sure, I think that's a very well laid out, and I think that it's good to have some number because that tells you what's your range, right? It really helps. You know, another thing that I wanted to understand was that, you know, when we all talk about alternates, and we just said that definitely the perception is for higher returns, but you know, returns per se is just one side of the coin, right? The important thing is the risk-adjusted returns because there is no free lunch. So, what's the kind of risk that one is taking to achieve those goals, right? Is something that we need to really evaluate. Is something what we need to also realize that how it played out, right? And I really always struggle with my investors when say, oh, your return is a little lower than the fund ABC. And then I say, but, you know, my idea was to take much lower risk and genuinely. And that's where the risk adjusted return comes into play. So how does one really sensitize the investors that return is only one side of the coin? As far, I mean, high returns for alternates is one side of the coin, but you need to really also understand the kind of the risk that one is taking.
So, you know, so taking a step back, and if I go for to what Sanketu said originally, Sanketu defined four asset classes as alternates, right? Forget PMS for a minute, but he also talked about, let's say, long short funds, right? From no stretch of imagination will I say that long short funds are high return, high risk gains, right? Compared to his defining crypto, compared to his defining private equity and debt, and compared to his defining REITs and InvITs as well, right? Because that's a that's an asset class that I believe is actually, I believe both long short funds and REITs and InvITs are asset classes that are becoming more and more mainstream actually. A traditional investor would actually, traditional investors are actually now getting into it more and more. So I do believe, coming back to what I had spoken about earlier, that it is, you have to look at it from a risk-adjusted return perspective. And it's just not about looking at, you know, chasing return, right? Risk is defined in very different manners, right? First is, I do believe that this is a hedge to traditional asset classes, because there is clear asset class diversity.
Sure.
It is clear, lower correlation to a lot of asset classes. I mean, let's take a perfect example, right? Let's take the whole credit fiasco that happened in mutual funds. I'm sure, given that Vikas has sat on AMFI, no mutual fund will be happy with me saying this. But the biggest problem that was that you had money coming in into an asset class where the security that you were holding was longer term in nature and was illiquid, whilst the freedom of the investor to come in and out was to a large extent of a very different nature. So forget, you know, so, and I think that was the crux of the issue, actually. I'm not talking about the nature or the quality, because I do believe that most fund managers held good quality stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So it's very important to define both instruments, vehicles that you're holding them through, the nature of the holding period versus the risk versus the standard deviation versus how it compares to traditional asset classes. And you have to think one level deeper within this. So the same principles that apply in public apply to private as well. It's as simple as that, right? If people get into this thinking only of high returns, they will 100% burn their hands, right? The nature of getting a person to buy a structured credit instrument, holding a single, you know, buying one single company and buying an MLD is very different from him buying a venture debt fund, is very different to buying a private equity, very different to buying a late stage private equity fund. And for all you know, all three of them are offering that 15 to 18% yield. So I mean, we can spend hours discussing this, but I believe that, see, my fundamental answer is that the nuance with which you look at public markets is how you have to look at private markets. So it's not about alternates any longer. There is the same amount of nuance, early, mid, late, you know, nature of fund managers, nature of holdings, quality of governance, all of that applies as much here as it does on the public market side.
Perfect. Thanks a lot. That's very, very insightful. Vikas, all yours.
So I've got terrific audience questions coming in, and some of them have come in on Twitter, directly mailed to me. Some of them are in the chat box here. Quite a few of them are perspectives. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to, you know, not talk about the perspectives. For example, Vikash Kothari talks about the own factor of AIF is like someone buying a BMW or Maruti, wherein the underlying is a car. So I'm not just going to go there. But these are perspectives, very interesting perspectives. I think quite a few of them have been generated after listening to you. So there are six questions I'm going to be talking about. And Nitin, please do let me know which question stimulates this discussion the most, because there's a prize for the best question. Kashyap Javeri asked the question, what is the global experience in terms of an inflection point for alternates to fly off? Even as Indians are aspiring, I'm sure the number of Indians with more than 1 billion investable surplus would be very pitiful compared to the developed markets. So what is the global experience in terms of inflection point for alternates to fly off? If I can just nuance it a bit, I think if you look at ETFs, typically, because I headed the ETF and indexing committee, I realized this, that typically it takes around 12 to 13 years minimum for an ETF to be part of the ecosystem, for it to be mainstream, and also institutional participation, which has just started happening here. So is there a similar template for alternates, or is it?
I think we are at that inflection point today.
Wonderful.
So as I was making the point earlier to you before we started, where we were talking about some people that we commonly knew, I have now in the last 6 months seen large domestic families, sophisticated family offices, insurance firms, banks, large institutional investors, all domestic, start to participate within the space. People are getting into early stage venture capital, people are getting into deep tech, people are getting into structured credit, people are getting into venture debt, people are wanting to, and by people, I mean the kind of people that I just spoke about, the institutional nature of the business, right? The regulatory environment has changed. IRDA allows, SEBI allows, EPFO has made some changes now.
Yes.
I think the point is now, this asset class is becoming mainstream.
Super.
As long as there are no crazy mistakes, and you know, and of course, market cycles will go through it, but this is going to become mainstream. You cannot ignore it any longer.
It reminds me of this this book which I have just read recently. Thank You for Being Late. It's written by Thomas Friedman, and he talks about the fact that the whole landscape, the global landscape, is changing because of three factors: change, rate of change, and global warming. And he says that the rate of change is now far more than the human's ability to adapt. So by the time you have rules for aggregators like Uber, you're already into driverless cars, right? So I guess alternates are actually going through the same thing. I think the rate of change is so fast.
I think also one very interesting thing that nobody has realized is how there's an ecosystem building around itself.
Yes.
There's an ecosystem that has got built up through, if we talk just on the equity side, startup ecosystem where people are becoming successful. People are monetizing, people are investing back into more and more companies, right? There is an ecosystem getting built up where traditional families and LPs want to future-proof their businesses and therefore are working with fund managers as well as companies in the space. There's a full ecosystem building up to how it used to be in public equities. And therefore, there's an ecosystem where, you know, so there's, you look at, I mean, whilst everybody's talking ill about crypto today, but blockchain is here to stay. Be it the largest bank to somebody like me, we all want to look at blockchain in terms of seeing how it changes the nature of our businesses and how it makes it more efficient. So I think this asset class is completely here to stay.
Fantastic. There's a very cryptic question from Sarjusha. I think what he's trying to ask is gold mainstream or alternate, and what is your outlook on gold?
So I think gold has always been mainstream. I still believe that gold as a traditional hedge to traditional asset classes remains. I do believe that with inflationary pressures that come up, which at some point of time will come up in a market like India and, you know, otherwise as well, right, gold needs to be there within client portfolios. The view to gold is anything there. I mean, if you remember, Vikas, I was telling you last time, Goldman published a report saying 10x on gold,
yeah,
right, which they did a few days ago. But I believe that if you are an asset allocator, see, money, it's a rule of thumb. Money is only made through two things. Money is made through asset allocation, and money is made through identification of the right managers,
okay,
that people below, right, which then translates into the right type of security. It's a three-stage perspective, right? And wealth managers play the role in the first two, and you know, people like you play the role in terms of being the right fund manager to invest in. So, you know. So I think gold similarly plays a role over there, where it's a traditional asset class. You have your 5% to 10% hedge, right? It'll only help you in those times when you need it to help you, and that is when it'll help you know, protect the downside on your portfolios in terms of generating counter-cyclical returns. Yeah, but it's, in my mind, it's a traditional asset class. It's not an alternate class.
So I have four more questions, considering that it's already 6:30.
That's fine.
So very quickly, if you can just outline your views on these questions. Do you see Indian wealth managers equipping themselves to the nuances of alternates? How can one keep oneself updated if one is a relationship manager?
Okay. Yeah, so I think wealth managers have to keep up with changing markets and new products and opportunities. It's a very competitive environment. It's an environment where there is a dog-eat-dog piece, and customers are becoming much more and more savvy and much more and more demanding. You know, we try to work with a lot of fund managers, both in debt and equity, and we try and keep ourselves connected with the updates and innovations that are happening within this market, right? And as a lot more alternate fund managers raise domestic capital, right, the information and knowledge amongst clients will only keep going up. You're seeing clients get into co-investment opportunities with with managers. You're getting them to see more and more nuanced in terms of how they're looking at questions. We also try to actively spend time in educating clients. You know, so we try and ensure there are regular sessions, webinars with managers, market experts. But see, this is a space where you need to work with the bigger names in the street, right? Because typically you need to have access, right? Which is very important, right? I mean, Evendus, for example, is connected right in the middle of this ecosystem. We are the people who created the digital, to a large extent, the digital revolution in India. We came out with that first 2010-11 report, which put Evendus on the map when we talked about digital, right, in India. Right? You need somebody who has great insight and expertise within this. And I would say that, see, and I'm just taking a nuance and you know, as I was telling you the class yesterday, pitching ourselves a little bit, but I joined about 2 years ago into this business, right? And we built a strong go-to-market around alternates, but we are just not an alternate player. But typically, clients are seeing the value add that we are giving because we've got a very strong platform that we built out across fixed income, across equity, across our family office, across what we do from a lending and advisory business, and across a key go-to-market, which is on alternates, right? To an extent where clients want to work with people who want to, you know, future-proof their portfolios. And we are seeing the market is trying to catch up, right? I mean, we also therefore have to keep running that much harder to continue to maintain our market position. But I think for customers, it's a great time because wealth managers will equip themselves more and more, right? They will become more and more nuanced in what they do. A lot of lessons have been learned over the last few years. And therefore, I think, I mean, there's no option. People have to equip themselves in this space.
Wonderful. So last three questions, two of them are fairly cryptic and I think you can answer them immediately or rather you choose not to answer if you want to. Somebody just asked me, Vishnu's asked me, what is the proportion of alternates versus conventional assets in your portfolio?
My own personal portfolio?
Yes.
So as I said, I was, you know, about 2 years ago when I moved from Sanchar to here, I had the definition of alternates I didn't understand, right? Because you're exposed by your own worldview.
Yes.
Right? And by access and opportunity. I'm currently sitting at roughly about 5-6%, but my intent over the next few years is to build this up to 15-20%. I'm exposed through funds more than deals because I believe that investing with high quality fund managers who will draw down capital over the course of the next few years, right, will give me better access to opportunities than being able to do it myself, right? And I'm truly excited about this space. But I also believe that it is that, you know, 80% of your portfolio is still traditional, right? And that will still move the needle, right? So for example, at Evendus, you know, I believe that we position ourselves as the people who can generate alpha for you, right? Because the same yardsticks that we are talking about on what we use on alternates or private, we also use on the public side of it, right? So therefore, answering Vishnu, right? Whilst I may have a 5% allocation to alternates, but I have a 70% allocation to risk assets, right? That's essentially it.
That's quite insightful. Thank you so much for sharing this. 5 years from now, this is Satyam asking a question. 5 years from now, what do you think will be the composition of the alternate space? If you look back, say, at 2026, what do you think would be considered as alternates at that point of time? Just crystal ball gazing here.
So I think a lot of the assets that we call alternate will become mainstream.
Yeah.
Right? And therefore, REITs, InvITs, long short, structured credit, venture debt, to a large extent, late stage private equity. I think maybe early stage might still stay a little bit over there. I don't have an answer to what new asset classes will emerge actually, because I never thought that there would be something called NFT. I never thought there would be something called bored apes, where you take photos of where you buy avatars of apes who are looking bored, and then they start from $10,000 and start selling for $2.7 million. I have a friend of mine who minted an NFT a few days ago. It was basically the photo of the Hong Kong skyline, and I'm still trying to think how that gets monetized. But I think this digital revolution will, you know, I think this new economy and the way new investors and, you know, the millennials, and I'm sounding very old, look at money is in a very different form and manner. So maybe I'm not able to answer this question, but I don't have a sense of what asset classes will truly emerge as new as alternates at that point of time. But I do believe that almost all of the asset classes that we're talking about today will be completely mainstream.
Very interesting, because while you were talking, I was just realizing that at one point of time, if you realize in Hindi commercial cinema, there used to be something called Bollywood and art films, right? The moment those art films moved on to the Netflix platform, OTT platform, they've suddenly become as commercial as you get.
Exactly.
So,
in fact, poor Bollywood has to come on to OTT.
So for all you know, space travel might be the alternate 5 years from now. You never know. Yeah. The last question, I think this is something which I particularly like. You have answered a bit of it, but just if you could nuance. You've got exposure to global clients as well as clients from India. Is there a difference in the mindset of the clients whom you've dealt with globally as well as the mindset of the clients you're dealing with here? This is the last question.
I would say, so let me talk through the experience of the last 2 years that we've dealt with over here in terms of clients. I believe the one aspect that global clients always had on domestic clients to a large extent was their access to information and their access to asset classes and their view of looking at asset classes globally, right? So then you could take country exposures, you could take asset class exposures. You had ways and means of getting into asset classes that were not available in India. And therefore, to a large extent, that information arbitrage, or that learning arbitrage, actually, the knowledge and learning arbitrage that existed for large families in India versus large families globally. You know, I mean, let's take an example, and it's just a name that I'm pulling out of random. But is there a difference today between a Wrigley family office and between one of the Infosys founders' family office? That might have been true a few years ago. I believe that gap has largely got bridged. I believe that traditionally, when you look at the way that they look at managers, the way that they look at opportunities, the insight that they have, the access that they have to opportunities, right, is more and more getting bridged. And I'm not talking, and I'm talking lesser about regulatory and LRS and liberalized whatever. But the way that you see it is rapidly getting bridged. I think a role is emerging there for players like us. And a few other players on the street who truly are trying to focus on value add. I'm going to give you an example. When I took over this business, we were about 24,000 crores of AUM. Today, we are sitting at about 40,000 crores plus of AUM in the space of about 14 or 15 months, right? And to a large extent, we've seen that addition happen through families like the ones that I'm talking about, where they are seeing more and more value happening because they are looking at working with these kind of managers. They want international opportunities. They want Indian opportunities. They want to get that insight that is happening. And similar questions, we have built out a US business, actually. And we have somebody sitting in the US today who offers India access to, for example, people like the Wrigley family office, right? I mean, we are not selling to them how I wish we were, but I'm just giving an example. And therefore, we are actually seeing this happen every day. We are seeing the questions that are asked there. We are seeing the questions that are asked here. We are seeing the questions that institutions are asking in India. We are seeing the questions that families are asking. It's all coming up. You know, that rising tide is taking up everybody up in terms of knowledge, etc. I think as access becomes more and more available, more and more democratized, as you see more and more families become truly international, this gap will also go away. Also, one very interesting trend, which is also happening on the non-HNI space, is the rapid democratization of availability of such opportunities. You're seeing interesting young kids open up platforms, you've got people. And I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that my son has never invested in a traditional asset class, but started first by investing in crypto. I mean, to give you an example. So I think at both ends, there's a rapid bridging of the gap between knowledge levels of domestic investors as well as versus offshore investors. And I've seen this firsthand. And, which is why I'm terribly excited about what this space represents over the next 5 to 7 years. I think domestic wealth is growing at a rapid pace. I think somebody told, I remember somebody saying that the number of millionaires are very few. I think that's
Kashyap. I think Kashyap was Kashyap Jhaveri. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's not true actually, because I think you're seeing a rapid pace of that. But you're seeing a rapid pace generally of financialization of savings happening.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing people becoming more and more erudite and selective about opportunities that they want to get into. You're seeing platforms emerge at both ends, both the UUHNI as well as on the more retailish side, which will lead to this. And I think both across traditional asset classes, be it on fixed income or equity, or be it on private markets, I think this is clearly the era of knowledge, of accountability, of value add, of getting into good assets is going to play out for them. And there will be a big difference between the losers and the winners in this space.
Amazing. I'm actually torn between two questions which I think deserve a prize. The one which Kashyap asked in terms of the inflection point for alternates and the exposure to global clients, your exposure to global clients and your view in terms of the mindset of these two. Which of these two would you pick for the prize question? Or should we give it to both?
I'm fine. Whatever you and Sachin believe.
It was wonderful. So congratulations, Kashyap and Satyam. Lovely questions. And I can still see questions coming in my Twitter feed directly. So, but I'm sorry, this is all the time we have. Sankalpa, over to you.
So, thank you, Vikas. Thank you, Nitin, for being so patient with us and answering all our questions. And I know for a fact you have an engagement soon. And in Bombay traffic, you might be late. But thank you so much for taking the time and, discussing all these things with us. And a lot of insightful things also we got to know about how to look at alternates, who should be investing in alternates. And thank you for even letting us know what is your proportion to, allocation to alternates. That's been very, very informative. Thank you to the audience for being as engaging and as participative as ever. Thank you, FinLearn, for the prizes. Thank you, Sachin. Thank you, Vikas. With that, I think we close season one and hope to see every one of you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all of you for asking me to join. So, thank you for your time.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Uncle. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye. Have a nice day.